This is Mountain News and World Report, WMMT's weekly sojourn into life in Central Appalachia. We now invite you to join us for a visit with folks you may or may not know, items of interest to us all, and shining moments in our living history.
I went to see my doctor because I couldn't get my breath. He said, boy, you got something could well mean your death. Your corneosis, black lung, blue. You get the one, you get the other, either way you lose. I've always been a miner, breathe coal dust all my life.
Hello and welcome to Mountain News. I'm your host, Rachel Geringer, and in this episode, we bring you the personal story of one miner living with black lung, who recently traveled to D.C. to ask Congress to uphold the Black Lung Disability Trust Fund. Then, from the Ohio Valley Resource, we learn how HIV rates are on the rise in counties hard hit by the opioid epidemic. But some community members still remain skeptical about harm reduction programs. And from WEKU's Eastern Standard, we hear about the history of the proposed Bunches Creek Dam that would have been situated just above Cumberland Falls. First, WMMT's Sydney Bowles interviewed Barry Johnson in late July. Johnson is a retired miner living with black lung, and Sydney spoke with him just before he set off on a trip to Washington, D.C. to ask Congress for help.
When I get up to heaven, St. Peter's gonna cry. But I tell him the reason this poor boy had to die. The corneosis, black lung, blue. You get the one, you get the other.
Back in July, a group of coal miners with black lung disease made the long trip to Washington, D.C. to ask Congress for help. The miners had a simple ask: raise the tax on coal that supports the Black Lung Disability Trust Fund. If Congress doesn't do that, fewer miners could get benefits, or taxpayers could have to pay for miners' health care instead of the coal companies that got them sick. I spoke with miner Barry Johnson before the trip to D.C.
Started underground 2-3 weeks after my 18th birthday. Loved it. Still do. I miss it. I've held a lot of different positions. Equipment operator, section foreman, mine foreman, superintendent, some work in safety. And then my MSHA time. So there's a camaraderie. It's just an environment that you have to experience to understand, but it's also one that's not for everybody.
Did you think, in, I don't know, was it on your mind in those early days that this could get you sick?
When I think any coal miner you talk to will tell you every day when you go underground, just as I said earlier, in your mind you're aware of all these things that you have to be vigilant for. And at the end of the day, when you come out and you're healthy and safe in one piece, and then you did well. You guarded against those things. And this is the same. You do your best to, but it's not on your mind every day in the same degree. And this disease is, it's not like you go underground today and you come out at the end of your shift and you've got black lung. You know, it's kind of a silent, sneaks up on you kind of thing, and you just don't really, expect it, even though it's out there. maybe, you know, maybe your breathing's decreased, your physical abilities decreased, but it does it so incremental that you don't really realize it until it's right in your face. I guess that's the best way I can describe it. So you have good days, bad days. The weather plays a big part. If it's too hot, too humid, it makes it really tough on you. If it's really cold, it makes it rough on you. And it really limits you. It not only does it affect your health specifically, but it affects your whole life and your family's life. You have to be, you're vigilant, I guess, is probably the best word. For instance, through flu season and when there's, you know, you're real hesitant about getting out in a crowd, been out in public places, and because you already have a compromised system and you really don't, you can't handle that. Yard work, simple things around home, you know, I'm planning on doing today, but you know, whether I can't. I want to go on vacation with the family, you have to look at, you're always looking at, you know, is this something that I'm going to have to walk a long distance? Is there a lot of stairs? And that's kind of where I'm at, is today going to be a good day, or is today a day I'm just going to have to kind of sit and wait it out?
What's today like?
Today's not a good day.
It sounds like, for a guy who takes a lot of pride in doing hard work underground, mm-hmm. it seems mm-hmm. like a really hard thing to wrap your mind around.
And it is. It's, I have said before, in one sense, it doesn't only take your health, it takes your identity, I guess, is a good way to put it, so.
But it also means that this trip that we're going on is going to be a real,
it's going to be tough.
Can you talk about that? Can you tell me why it's so important to you to make this trip?
It's very simple. It's a matter of life and death. The funding for the Disability Trust Fund, the fund is, especially in today's environment with the industry, we see companies that go, the medical needs of these people have to be met. I mean, if this thing isn't addressed and taken care of, then these folks, it's a matter of life and death. It literally, truly can mean the difference between this breath and the next.
That was, you put that really well, but my understanding is that the trust fund, like the miner's payments, are not immediately at risk, right? Because if...
To my knowledge, it's not. But I think in the broader picture, we have to look down the road. Now, we've had, of course, some indication last year that the excise tax was not going to get into an expiration situation. Well, it did. We're 7 months into that now. I have progressive massive fibrosis, complicated black lung. And I'm going to die. It's going to kill me eventually. Now, a lot of these, you know, there are a lot of us. So maybe the fund is short and maintained for the time we have left. Now that, you know, maybe that's a year, maybe that's 10 years, maybe that's 20 years. I don't know. But with the numbers that we're seeing and the number of people who are going to come into this system, the long term is what really matters.
I feel like McConnell's a big one in this.
In regard to Senator McConnell, he has he's in a powerful position. He has a lot on his shoulders in the position. He carries a lot of responsibility to the nation as a whole in his position. But at the same time, you know, he's still an elected senator with a constituency who elected him to represent their interest. And that's, I think, first and foremost. We weren't supposed to be in an expiration situation with the excise tax, and we're 7 months in, so.
I want you to speak to me as though I was him, as though I was Senator Mitch McConnell sitting 2 feet away from you. What would you say?
You have a duty, and you have an obligation. You know what needs to be done. Do what's right.
I spoke with Barry again, right after he left Senator McConnell's office.
Okay. Mr. Barry Johnson, walk me through it. What happened?
Senator McConnell just came in, addressed the group briefly, for a couple of minutes, reassured us that they were working on some options. The fund would remain solvent, the benefits were safe, and basically left then, and we addressed our concerns with members of his staff. But in the end, we walked out the door knowing as much about how this is going to be fixed as we did when we walked in.
What's going on, as I understand it, what's going on is McConnell has promised that benefits won't be cut, but that is
correct. That was stated during the meeting.
But it seems like, you know, you all want the tax on coal to be raised, but he's saying he might find another way to get that done. Is that right?
We have asked for the excise tax to be reinstated at least to the previous level. Again, the only answers we got were that there were some options they were looking at, and some different folks they were talking to, committees and agencies and so forth, and they were working on a solution. There was never any broader statement of what that might be, so who knows?
How does that feel to you?
Stalemated. I don't feel we lost anything, but I don't really feel we gained much. It's kind of hard to put a lot of faith in the statement that, you know, everything's going to be okay if you can't tell me how everything's going to be okay.
We're kind of at the end of, I mean, there are a couple more things today and tomorrow, but this was kind of the last hurrah of the trip.
Yes.
So how do you feel about the trip as a whole?
Great. I think when we leave here tomorrow, there'll be a few more people with this issue on their radar than there were when we arrived yesterday evening. And that's a good thing.
That's a good thing. Yeah.
That's a good thing. We accomplished our goal time will tell the measure of that accomplishment.
Thanks, Barry.
Thank you.
For WMMT, I'm Sydney Bowles.
Next, Ohio Valley Resource reporter Mary Meehan brings us a story about needle exchange programs closing across the region while HIV rates rise in counties hardest hit by the opioid epidemic.
Health officials in Huntington, West Virginia, say a cluster of HIV infections has grown to 71 confirmed cases. That's in a city that usually sees about 8 HIV infections in a year. As with an earlier such cluster in northern Kentucky, the primary cause of infection is needle drug use. Health officials say harm reduction programs are an effective tool against HIV, offering needle exchanges and health screening services. But as Mary Meehan explains, many people are wary of syringe exchanges. And in some places, that means programs are closing just when they're most needed.
Dr. Greg Corby Lee is the strategist for the University of Kentucky's Harm Reduction Initiative. He says community-based harm reduction programs can be a lifeline for those still using drugs.
You know, it takes a while for them to build that level of trust up, to come in. But that's their one bridge where they can be respected and be given nothing but help to stay healthy.
He says HIV is the primary focus.
The programs are to prevent HIV. That's what they were designed for, but there are a lot of other benefits that come with it.
He says prevention and testing for HIV are becoming more widely available, and stigma is gradually diminishing. But he and other health officials say there's also a backlash in many communities that threatens the harm reduction programs. Daniel Raymond is Deputy Director of Planning and Policy for the National Harm Reduction Coalition. He says some harm reduction services are closing.
A lot of these programs have been starting in communities that don't have a long history with harm reduction. So the programs that end up being at risk of closure are often the ones that are getting scapegoated for a community's drug problem.
Dr. Michael Brummage says that's part of a problem he encountered when leading a program in Charleston, West Virginia.
And I think it's a simplistic view to look at and blame one program for all of a city's woes, with homelessness, with drug use, with all these other things.
The deeper issue, he says, is that the HIV threat is real and not going away. Less prevention equals more sick people. In Huntington, one person in the HIV cluster has died.
Some people in that community are saying, well, look, we have the syringe program and we still got HIV. Maybe we just need to close the program. Well, I mean, the fact that you have a fire doesn't mean you should close the fire department. You know, you bring more trucks on the scene, and my guess is had Huntington not had a syringe program, this problem would have exploded far worse than happened in Scott County, Indiana.
Scott County, Indiana, population 4,200, had 214 HIV cases in 2015. It was the nation's largest rural outbreak, and it became a bellwether for finding the best places to employ harm reduction programs.
This is a nationwide problem, and the boomerang effect, the recoil, is going to be if these programs start closing, you're going to see explosions of bloodborne pathogens, specifically HIV.
Still, harm reduction proponents remain optimistic. The National Harm Reduction Coalition says that for every program closing, 20 more open. Van Ingram is head of Kentucky's Office of Drug Control Policy. He says the spread of harm reduction programs requires a fundamental shift in thinking of drug use as a health problem instead of a problem for law enforcement. But it's happening.
I'll tell you that with 56 programs, I never dreamed we'd have this many. I'm glad to say I was wrong.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Mary Meehan.
Last in this episode of Mountain News, WEKU's Tom Martin recently spoke with Aaron Purcell, an archivist at Virginia Tech and a Rockcastle County native, about his research into Appalachia's historic relationship with tourism.
Aaron Purcell is an archivist at Virginia Tech, and he's in Kentucky as part of a fellowship to do research at the University of Kentucky, the Filson Historical Society, and the Kentucky Historical Society. Aaron is a native of Rockcastle County and went to college at Cumberland College. and he has studied the historical record of the Appalachian region's on-again, off-again flirtations with tourism. We thank you for stopping by, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
And if you would tell us about the project that brings you home to Kentucky.
Sure. I'm working on a project to document the history of the Bunches Creek Dam proposal, which the Army Corps of Engineers put forward starting in about 1959 and reached ahead around 1965. And it ended up being defeated because of opposition from conservationists, mostly.
So you have studied, pretty much poured through the papers of Kentucky Senators Thurston Morton, who served from 1957 to 68, and John Sherman Cooper, also a Kentucky Republican, who served in the Senate from 56 to 73. And among these papers, you found many talking about the challenges faced by southeastern Kentucky, many of them still being discussed today, a half century later. Tell us what you found.
Looking at the papers of those two congressmen, we're looking at different topics such as environmental protection, the brain drain that was occurring in these regions, and the lack of flood control. Looking at those different documents, there's a yes for, and then there's a no against that each of the senators put together. And they were both very in the middle of the road. They wanted to see what the report said from the Army Corps to figure out how much it was going to cost, what actually were the benefits. And it really pitted the private interests of business. Many of the people in Williamsburg and Corbin, Whitley City, those parts of the state, against environmentalists, largely from places like Lexington, Louisville, Frankfort, some of the more urban areas. But across the board, people were kind of torn. They wanted the development and a chance to have a better economic future for their children, but they also didn't want to give up the natural beauty of the falls.
And would this dam have been downstream? In other words, would it have covered the falls?
So the predecessor to this was a plan in the 1920s by private power companies to build a dam upriver from the falls. And in order to control the water, they would have an 80-foot tall dam. Then they would drill a large tunnel that would go all the way to beneath the dam because there is a curve in the river. So the water would be diverted through this tunnel, thus controlling the flow over the falls, and the hydro plant would be downstream. This plan in the 1960s was basically the exact same thing. So the Army Corps argued that it wouldn't destroy the aesthetics of the spot, but environmentalists often brought in a religious meaning to this, saying if we start messing with what God had created for us, we're going to somehow destroy it.
And so who won?
The environmentalists won out in terms of raising their voices and creating enough opposition in Frankfort. The governor's office and the legislators in Frankfort ended up deciding this isn't something that we want to do because the dam itself was going to be built inside of a state park. It wasn't as if it was going to be built outside or further upriver, but that involved the state of Kentucky. So the Park Service was very much against it. And then the Army Corps did a report, and the report kind of lessened the benefits because the Army Corps wasn't about creating electric power. That wasn't their duty. They were there to provide flood control. The way that it was designed, it was supposed to protect Williamsburg, where I went to school at Cumberland College, from flooding, which still has that problem. But their report said it would not really alleviate a whole lot of flooding in the other areas that would be backed up behind the reservoir.
Hmm. So what we have here really is a textbook example of that collision between protection of natural spaces versus human development.
Plus, you could see the dam from DuPont Lodge. That was one of the big environmentalists' biggest problem, is you would be sitting there enjoying the beauty and the scenery, and then you would see this 80-foot concrete behemoth that was in the middle of the river.
Many in eastern Kentucky are having conversations around the idea of at least some economic salvation in tourism. This is also a conversation that's been going on for many years.
Well, I think the idea of opening up the area to more access points. The other thing that happened in 1964 was the Wilderness Act, which really defined what could and couldn't be developed in a national park or, in some cases, state parks, preserves, land conservancies, those sorts of things. So the idea was that the way to protect it is to limit access to everyone. The idea of ecotourism, I think, is to open up the space a bit more. There was always the argument with Cumberland Falls that you go and you see the waterfall and there's a lodge and a hotel, and that's about it. So the idea of developing something more, the Army Corps believed that with better regulation of the water flow, they could actually create a much nicer reservoir behind it, which would allow for fishing, boating, skiing, all those different things. Because, again, in the 1960s, it was very fashionable for water control projects to equal economic stimulation.
How can this history that you're studying inform the discussions that are now taking place among many stakeholders in the region?
Well, that's a good question. I think the pros and the cons of this project would pretty much be the same today. There would be a large number of business interests who would say this would allow a better future for our children, for the region, which is still economically depressed. But I think that there's a middle ground here, maybe not building a dam, but expanding some of the natural areas, more hiking trails, more tourism, if there is a way to do that comfortably. It's easy to look at some national parks that perhaps did a little too much of that. Great Smoky Mountains is a good example. There are many people who go to the Great Smoky Mountains but never actually get to the mountains. They're doing shopping while they're there. I'm not sure that is the answer for Cumberland Falls and other places that are natural and protected like that. But I think there is a way to do it in such a way to respect the nature and allow access to anyone who wants to come and use it.
You know, it's interesting. I've mentioned a couple of times that these are conversations that have been going on for decades, generations. But there is something different about this time that we're in now. Never before have we seen something that was taken for granted, coal, in such decline, if not collapse. So that big chunk of the southeastern Kentucky economy is being at least reduced, if not removed, which creates an imperative to turn to something else, that being tourism. What do you think about that dynamic, the fact that that's being removed from the discussion now and maybe there's more of an imperative?
One thing to look at are the census numbers that this area that I'm talking about here has continued to lose population mm-hmm. because, as many of the people in the 60s said, our children will have no place to go once they graduate high school. In order to be successful, they have to move somewhere else. And so the idea was this dam was somehow the savior of that. The idea of creating some sort of tourism happened in the county over from there with Big South Fork, which was also, and I won't get into this too much, at the same time this project was proposed, there was another one called Devil's Jump, which was basically going to do the exact same thing where they created the Big South Fork. And that is an area that does have national protections as a national park. But when you look at the amount of tourism dollars coming in there, I can't imagine it is significant enough to make the population of McCreary County and others there in Tennessee to continue to go up. So I don't know if protecting more lands is the way to do it. It seems like providing more access would be a starter for that.
Virginia Tech archivist and researcher Aaron Purcell, welcome back to Kentucky for your visit here, and we thank you so much for stopping by Eastern Standard.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for this episode of Mountain News. If you'd like to hear this or previous episodes again, you can find them on our website at wmmt.org, or find Mountain News as a podcast on SoundCloud or Stitcher. Music on this episode features Rich Kirby and Michael Klein with a tune called Black Lung Blues from their album They Can't Put It Back. That album was released by Appleshop's own June Apple Recordings in 1977. I've been your host, Rachel Geringer, and from all of us at WMMT, thanks for listening to Real People Radio. Breathe coldest all my life, too old to learn a new trade, but can I tell my wife to comb corneas? Black lung blues. You get the one, you get the other, either way you lose.
I'll tell nobody nothing. I'll just keep working on.
This has been Mountain News and World Report, a production of WMMT-FM, Mountain Community Public Radio, the non-commercial broadcast service of the world-famous Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky.